This is Space Kate in Florida, and I'm here doing the Space Studies program at the International Space University, and we've been learning all sorts of fascinating things. I've managed to snag one of our lecturers, and it's Dr. Jim Green. He is NASA's Director of Planetary Sciences. Now, before we go any further, that sounds like a pretty incredible title. Do you want to just explain, what is your day-to-day job?
Well, I am the top advocate for planetary science in the federal government. And so I work at NASA headquarters. You know, we work with the administration and with Congress, and we set the budget. We also work with the community in terms of planning out our next set of missions. And anything that leaves the Earth, that doesn't either look at the Earth or look at the sun or look at stars, are missions that are in my directorate.
That sounds like quite a big and exciting job to have. How did you get to that point in your life when you were kind of that high up at NASA doing really cool things?
Well, I'd graduated at the University of Iowa, and then I went to Marshall Space Flight Center for about 5 years, and then I went to Goddard Space Flight Center for another 20 years or so. And so I was a scientist. I'm a magnetospheric physicist, which means that anything with a magnetic field I enjoy and love. But over time, I always knew that I needed to go down to NASA headquarters. NASA headquarters is really not about doing science, but facilitating science. It's all about figuring out what the future of the field will be doing and how do we obtain the funding and the support to get us there. And so when this position came up and I applied for it, I never thought that I would end up at NASA headquarters at this level, but that's how it happened.
Oh, congratulations. I'm hoping you're enjoying it as much as I think any of us on this course would be enjoying a job like that. Now, I'm just thinking back to the lecture you gave us yesterday, and you were saying, basically, space is not empty. There is a lot of stuff out there. Now, bearing in mind that we're quite a lucky and smart group here, we all have a big fascination with space, but not everybody else in the world does. Let's just start very basically. There's a lot of stuff in space. What is it?
Well, one of the life science instructors said that when you go into space, everything in space is trying to kill you. You know, there's no air, you got to bring your food, you've got to manage your resources because you only can take a limited amount of stuff. But in reality, that's also true for anything we launch that is a robotic mission. In fact, the environment is full of high-energy particles. Some of these particles move so fast, they'll go right through the spacecraft from one end of it to the other. They'll affect circuits. They'll change things like memory or certain gates that then will turn off instruments or make spurious commands. And so it can be a very harsh environment, and some places are worse than others.
So if it's such a harsh environment out there, how are we even surviving on our dear planet Earth?
Well, it's taken now about 50 years to really get a good idea as to what that environment is all about. And so we've studied the sun. We've studied a lot about the galaxy. We've studied a lot about the planets. And we recognize how these things interact and where some of these particles come from. But we have a lot of surprises in store for us. In fact, we can actually tell that we have not seen everything that the sun can put out. There's been things in the history of humans here on Earth that indicate that the sun can really crank out some enormously fast particles that can affect anything in space, spacecraft, and of course human travel. So. We have a basis of knowledge, and it's from that basis we're going to continue to grow and understand, and that'll be necessary if and when we leave low Earth orbit, trek out into the solar system, going to the moon or asteroids or eventually to Mars.
Okay, so talking about the sun, I mean, everybody on Earth is familiar with the big glowing ball of fire that's up in the sky that keeps us warm and helps us get the energy that we need to survive, but there's a little bit more to the sun than just a big glowing ball, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the sun is not only has this what we call a benign surface, perhaps. It has various aspects of it where huge magnetic fields can create very high energy particles. It produces flares. It also produces coronal mass ejections where the atmosphere of the sun can blow off and billions of tons of material can fly into space. And it does, in many cases, slam into our planet as it does many of the other planets in the solar system.
And what are there effects that we can see on Earth from these coronal mass injections?
Yes. Coronal mass ejection, when it hits the Earth's neighborhood, it actually hits the Earth's magnetic field first. And it pushes that magnetic field and it rearranges that magnetic field. And the end result is an aurora borealis or aurora australis if you're in the southern hemisphere. So if you haven't seen aurora, I would encourage everyone to do that. What's happening when you see aurora is it's really telling you what's happening very deep into space. Particles are accelerated, they come down our magnetic field, and they rain on our upper atmosphere and generate a beautiful light show.
One of my ambitions, actually, having seen some of Doug Wheelock's photographs from the International Space Station of the aurora borealis from space, is to get up into space and see that sight. But then again, you've made it sound like a pretty dangerous place out there, so how do these kind of solar activities affect humans in space, and what can we do about it, especially if we're maybe planning a mission to Mars? You don't really want to get caught up in a huge solar storm, or can we protect ourselves?
Well, we know enough about some of these storms to determine that with proper shielding, and in some cases that's water, in some cases that's a thick aluminum area, it depends upon how intense these particles are, that you could actually shield most of the radiation. Now, when you get hit by high-intensity particles, they may kill cells. When they do that, as cells reproduce, if they don't reproduce correctly, then you have a cancer. And what happens is people may become more prone to cancer later in their life after they've been in space and come back down. But we're also learning a lot about the biology of how to fight cancers, how to be able to train our body in a variety of ways to be able to survive long periods of time so that we die by other causes before cancer would kill us.
So on Earth we've got the magnetosphere and the atmosphere which are kind of shielding us and protecting us from this dangerous stuff that's out there. We've heard a lot of talk in the last few days about at some point needing to get off this planet because we have sadly seem to have destroyed it in some way, and a lot of people are talking about maybe looking at Mars as a next place for us to live. What kind of challenges would face us if we decided to try and populate Mars?
Well, Mars is also a very extreme environment. It doesn't have a magnetic field like the Earth, so it can't protect us from a lot of the solar wind. Mars also has a very thin atmosphere, and unfortunately not an atmosphere we can breathe either. So there's a huge lack of oxygen to be able to breathe on Mars. But Mars has a number of fabulous aspects about it. It's in a region for which we believe that there's liquid water, primarily underneath its surface. We've seen a number of buried glaciers now on Mars. There might actually be a fair amount of water. It also has a variety of resources that we could probably use to be able to survive in long periods. But it is, if we go to Mars, it's really hearkening back to the time when pioneers would trek out, land in this country in the United States, and then forge a new life elsewhere. It will be hard, it'll be difficult, there'll be extreme challenges. But from what we know, there's absolutely nothing stopping us from doing that other than the will to do it and the money to do it.
Which are no small obstacles.
Yeah.
So you're there at NASA headquarters, you're looking at the future of planetary sciences. Is there anything from that future that you care to share with us? What do you think will be the kind of big things we'll be looking at in, say, 5 or 10 years?
Well, in 5 or 10 years, a lot will happen. We'll have flown by Pluto, and we'll see what a brand new type of object called a dwarf planet. It's part of a set of objects that extend well beyond Pluto, called the Kuiper Belt. We'll also understand much more about the interior of Jupiter. We have a mission called Juno, and Juno will reach Jupiter in 2016. We'll also have reached a beautiful, huge asteroid, spherical asteroid, called Ceres. And that's also an object of intense study. So we'll really be opening up a number of fabulous science activities, and we'll be charting the course on some new missions. New missions going back to Mars. New missions perhaps going back to Jupiter and visiting some of the Galilean moons, where there are potential for a possible life that exists on some of these moons, deep buried in oceans that exist inside, let's say, Europa. So there's a lot of things that we have to look forward to. But I've told a number of people in the community that I plan to be the head of planetary science at NASA headquarters when we find life beyond Earth.
That would be a very cool thing. And I guess we're coming up pretty quickly to the landing of the Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity, which, as I understand it, is holding some instruments which may at least start to discover whether we have organics on the planet. I've been following some of Chris McKay's work, and it'll be following up on previous missions that have been there, which couldn't quite explain what they were finding. How hopeful are you that the Mars Science Laboratory will bring back some positive results?
Well, Curiosity rover, when it lands safely on Mars, which will happen August the 6th if you're on the East Coast, August the 5th if you're on the West Coast of the United States, will begin a fabulous several-year set of scientific experiments that it will do. It's landing in a very unique place. It's landing at a place where there are clays and sulfates. We see these from orbit, so we know that this is an old location. Clays occur, and particularly the sulfates, in regions where there's been water, and a fair amount of water, water that's grown and then evaporate, depositing sulfates on the surface. So Mars is Curiosity is going to a location that goes back in time. It's really going to a region that's several billion years old, where we believe Mars was very wet and possibly had the habitability for life. And so it's a great step forward, and we're really quite excited about what Curiosity will find.
Well, I'm very, very much hoping to be at JPL when she lands safely, so I'll be keeping my fingers crossed and definitely following that mission. Thank you ever so much for taking your time to talk to me, and the lectures are great, so thank you.
My pleasure.